Thanks again. Very excited to be here today. I will explain my title in a little bit as we go through the talk. But yeah, please interrupt me, and happy to chat with anybody later today. Yes, so right. So before we talk about how GAPS is distributed across the universe, I would like to talk a bit about how I travel across the globe and end up here, or where I'm moving. Jesse already summarized it very well. So I just wanted to point out that I was born in south of Vietnam. Saigon is the name of the city. Attended college there before I moved to Europe for my master and PhD. So this is, I think this was me when I was first taken to a theme park when I was probably 4 or 5 years old. And I was pretty excited. So if you're thinking, well, Minh said he's very excited to visit, but he doesn't look so excited, then this is me when I was excited. So, again, I'm moving to KPIP in New Tokyo. And they promised me that I will be able to help hosting a lot of workshops there. So if you plan to visit, and if please keep an eye out for the workshops. So in the first part of the talk, I will be talking about growth of structure within a linear regime. So everything I said, or mostly most things I said, will be restricted to this regime. And because we usually quantify the growth of structure using the sigma 8 parameter, the amplitude of matter fluctuations, I will be discussing the sigma 8 tension. This is an important tension, if true. So I will be discussing what can be the factor driving this tension, whether this is new physics or systematics. And it will be based on this paper with Trajan Huter and Yu-Wei Wen at the University of Michigan. Right. So this seminar consists of mostly cosmology, so I don't want to talk too much about the basics, but I just want to point out from this beautiful cartoon by Jesse the fact that during cosmic time, the growth of density fluctuations under the effect of gravity is always tied up to the expansion of the smooth background being driven by dark energy. So this this makes it often difficult to disentangle between these two effects and to quantify whether we are see any deviation from the standard model. So again, to set the stage and to look closer into the growth of matter density fluctuations, I just want to show this simulation from the Flamingo project, where you can see as time goes by, as indicated on the top left corner, by the redshift, you can see that structures start to collapse, and then we start to form the cosmic filaments and the nodes with the cluster sitting at the nodes. So the structures become more and more hierarchical and complex. However, if we zoom out a little, or equivalently, if we smooth things further and further, then there is a certain regime where the fluctuations are very linear, are very Gaussian, so to speak. In fact, in Fourier space, all the fluctuations on the Fourier modes can be perfectly described by just a multivariate normal distribution with a diagonal covariance set by the linear matter power spectrum, as we are used to. Now to the observations. How do we quantify the growth of structure? Well, we have a couple of options. The first option is obviously the cosmic microwave background, CMB photons, and the anisotropies in the CMB. However, we do not directly observe the CMB. So as photons come to our telescope, there is gravitational interaction between the photons and the structures in between. So we have to model, and we can also extract information from the CMB lensing as well. Anything that radiates light can also serve as the backlight, not just CMB. So we also can use the distant galaxies and their light being distorted by the structure in between. And such correlations between the gaseous shape and the cosmic is called cosmic shear. Gravitational interactions also pull galaxies together. So we also have the correlation between galaxy and galaxy position, between galaxy and galaxy. So that's galaxy clustering. And then the cross correlation is by galaxy-galaxy lensing. So these make the 3 by 2 point analysis in galaxy weak lensing surveys. Right. So now with all the probes, we can start to quantify or put them together. And the proxy that we usually use is the sigma 8 parameter, the variance or amplitude of matter fluctuations within the spheres of 8 megaparsec over h. Here, I just want to stretch that the quantity sigma 8 that we use is an extrapolation rather than a measurement, because we measure the growth of structure at different redshifts, and then we extrapolate to redshift 0, assuming some certain model. And so measurements of growth of structure at different redshifts then is a consistency test of the assumed model, usually lambda CDM. So this is important to keep in mind, and I will come back to this later. Again, just to separate the probes that I showed, the early universe probe are typically cosmic microwave background and the effect of gravitational lensing on such observation. The effect is basically a smoothing of the semi anisotropy angular power spectrum because it's a convolution. And then we can also use this effect to reconstruct the mass of the mass map of matter in between. Such a probe is called CMB lensing. I just want to point out for this audience is, or remind people rather, is the fact that CMB lensing typically probe structure redshift 1 to 3. So the kernel is picked a little higher than the kernel for Yaxley lensing. Right, and then that's the early universe. For the late universe measurements, we have, as mentioned, the Yaxley 3x2 point correlation functions, or the Yaxley clustering in real showing here in real space and in Fourier space as the correlation function and the power spectrum. And then in the later universe, so at lower redshifts, we have Yaxley peculiar velocities, where we have combined distant indicators and cosmological redshifts in order to trace the peculiar motions of the galaxies. So putting everything together, here I'm showing two examples. In red is the Planck CMB anisotropies and lensing combined. And then in violet is the 3x2 points measurements from the dark energy survey. As you can see, the early and late universe probes typically prefer a higher and lower sigma 8 amplitude within that flat lambda CDM model. And it's not just Planck and DES. In this plot here, you can see the top measure, the top results from CMB typically, you know, prefer a higher S8, which is a combination of sigma 8 and omega m, compared to the, we can say safely, the low redshift measurements. However, this is not a tension in measurement. This can also be a tension in an extrapolations, assuming lambda CDM. So what are the implications if we relax the assumption of the relaxed lambda CDM model? This is what I'm going to discuss in the next few slides. in this paper with Dragan and Yue, we consider a very simple implementation in which we relax the assumption of flat lambda CDM by trying to separate the effect of the expansion of the background and the growth of density fluctuations. One can do so by noticing that, you know, in flat lambda CDM, the expansion of the cosmic background is completely quantified by the density parameter omega m. So if you parameterize the linear growth rate by omega m to the power of gamma, any deviation of growth of structure from flat lambda CDM is now entirely captured by gamma. So with this parameterization, you can then just integrate to get the linear growth rate, linear growth factor, and then that you then just rescale your linear matter power spectrum everywhere by d square. So now let me just show you the result. We consider, you know, many different combinations of data sets, and they individually and jointly prefer a higher gamma than the prediction by flat lambda CDM, which is 0.55, as I'm showing here. And let me just remind people that, you know, a higher gamma than 0.55 means a smaller f or a slower growth rate, because omega m is smaller than 1. So So that's what we mean when we say high gamma means suppressed growth rate of structure. Yeah, so this is very interesting, but it's also a very simple approach. I think, in fact, too simple that we were surprised by how the public reacted to it, but also the experts was not very happy with the approach. So, for example, David Sperger was quoted saying that, "I'm not sure I would have published this paper." And actually, I'm glad that David thinks so, because otherwise, I'm sure he would have published it way before I could. But yeah, that's some interesting difference reactions. Yeah, so now let me come back to what this means really, because because what it's usually hard to map between gamma and, you know, like other effects or other anomalies that we see from the data. So in this plot on the left, I'm showing two curves. The black curve is basically the growth rate in flat lambda CDM, constrained by the Planck CMB data and the F sigma 8 measurements from different gapsy surveys and peculiar velocity survey. Now, if you allow gamma to be free, then what the data prefers is the orange curve, the same data. And the orange curve shows a higher gamma, which is a suppressed F sigma 8 at late times, and most significantly between or below redshift 0.5. In this case, it's a 4.2 sigma discrepancy. But what does that mean? If you translate, if you look instead into the plan of gamma and S8, you can see that within Flanda CDM, where you have gamma fixed to 0.55, there's a 3.2 sigma tension between the constraints from CMB and large scale structure, which is a combination of F sigma 8 and ES and VAO. If you leave gamma to be free, if you allow it to leave the plan of 0.55, you can see that the constraints start to reconcile with CMB going to lower S8 and large scale structure going to higher S8. We also looked into other anomalies, for example, the Planck CMB anisotropies and polarization in temperature and polarization was known to prefer a universe with negative omega k. So if you allow gamma to be free, you can see that there's a degeneracy between gamma and omega k such that higher gamma brings you back to zero omega k. So that's also an interesting observation. And then to collect all the anomalies together, we looked into the residuals between the best fit model and the data in models where we have free gamma, free omega k, or free A-lens, a consistency parameter to check the consistency within general relativity and flat lambda CDM. So in this case, you can see that all the residuals follow the same oscillatory pattern, which indicates that whatever you know, whatever extensions models that you are considering, they are driven by the same data feature. So again, it could be new physics, or it could just be systematics, and that remains to be investigated further. So let's assume that the sigma 8 or SA tension has the physical origin. I just want to point out that what I have been discussing so far usually can be classified into, you know, physics of new properties of dark energy or dark matter interaction on large scale or modified gravity, because such modifications is scale independent. However, in the literature, there are also scale dependent proposals where you can have self-interacting or decaying dark matter. Dark matter can be ultralight axions, or you can also have new physics in baryons. So how do we distinguish between these scale independence and scale dependence modifications? Well, the complication is because CMB and CMB lensing typically probes not just the early universe, but also large scales. While gapsy weak lensing surveys probe typically not only the late universe, but also the small scales. So to me, at least, gapsy clustering is a perfect candidate to pinpoint the origin of the tension if it is physical, because galaxy clustering typically probes not just the late universe, but also the large to intermediate scales. So with that, I will try to bridge into the second part of the talk, where, you know, for sure, DESI will be able to, if there's anything interesting, DESI will be able to see it. But in the meantime, there's also we are also developing new approaches, trying to squeeze out as much as we can from galaxy clustering surveys. And such a new method will be the focus of the second part. But I feel like I can take some questions if you have some quick questions about the first part. Okay, if not, then let me continue. So the second part of the talk will be about this paper, and it will now, the focus will shift to nonlinear information, nonlinear clustering, instead of linear regime of the first part. Why do we want to go beyond the linear theory? Well, because in linear regime, there's a perfect degeneracy between the galaxy bias or the response of galaxy formation to large scale fluctuations. And we can only observe the galaxies instead of matter, so we always have to deal or to live with this galaxy bias. So in this very simple cartoon, I'm just trying to illustrate galaxy bias by showing a long wavelength fluctuations and the short wavelength fluctuations. So we can see that if we believe that galaxies form on the peaks of the density field be above a certain threshold, then in this very simple scenarios, we typically form more galaxies in this region compared to this region. And because we can only observe galaxies, it's often hard to tell whether we are living actually in a denser universe or we are just observing galaxies that form at the peak of a long wavelength fluctuations. So fortunately for us, again, Einstein comes to the rescue. So the equivalence principle was framed that you usually in a scenario where you're sitting in or standing in an elevator, but it's the same whether you're sitting or standing in an elevator or in a galaxy. So in our scenario, it usually means that on large scale, galaxies and matter should co-move in the same way. There should be no velocity bias on large scales. And because of this simple fact, we can break the degeneracy between V1, the linear galaxy bias, and sigma 8 by considering nonlinear clustering. This is the only technical slide I have, so please bear with me. So if we expand the matter density fields beyond the linear density field, then we can see that at second order already, there is a contribution that contains the displacement field. And because the equivalence principle demands that the displacement field is the same for galaxy and matter, this term has to be multiplied by the same linear galaxy bias V1. And you can notice that this term has a different scaling with the linear matter density field. So this breaks the degeneracy when you go beyond linear clustering. So this is a cosmology audience, so I will want to make you guess which one is galaxy and which one is random. I just want to say that when we go beyond linear clustering, we want to also go beyond the power spectrum because there's much more information, non-linear information beyond the power spectrum. In this case, the galaxy and random distribution has the same power spectrum, in fact. Maybe I want to spend more time on this plot. For this audience. So in this very nice paper by Caron, he considered a log normal distribution and the distribution of the Fisher information in the end moments of the field. So in the three cases, you can see that the variance of the field is varied. So a higher variance means a more nonlinear of fluctuations. And then you can see when the nonlinear, the variance increases, more and more information is distributed or is moved towards the higher end voice moments. This plot is trying to say the same. It's just the fraction of information contained in the, I think, the mean and the variance of the field. So as you can see, if the variance increases, more and more information is not captured by the first two moments of the field. So we can consider to continue the endpoint function hierarchy forever, or we can just directly consider, you know, just model the galaxy density field or the observed galaxy field at the field level. In this case, the proposal is that we start with the initial conditions of the universe, which we know are very close to Gaussian, and then the cosmological parameter. With those ingredients, we can forward model the whole field to try to predict the galaxy field that we should observe. And then we can repeat that scenario multiple times, trying to compare the prediction with the data at the field level to extract cosmological information. Previously, this would be prohibitive, and also the information wouldn't be, the information gain wouldn't be so much, but even the improvement of computational power and also the fact that we are now observing with DESI, for example, millions of galaxies, this is becoming more and more promising and also feasible. So I just want to, before we see some comparisons and results, I want to mention another ingredient of our approach, which is effective field theory. And the idea is very simple. We say, well, we trust our theory only up to a certain scale, above which we do not, we completely agnostic, and we have to marginalize over these scales. So with that, for the case of galaxy clustering, that means below some certain scale where the boundary physics and, you know, like any complex physics might happen, we say we are agnostic to these scales and we marginalize over them, only focusing on the reaction of the galaxy formation to the large wavelength fluctuations. If you do this, you can write out the expansion of the galaxy density field as a Taylor expansion with operators constructed out of the large scale fluctuations, typically the density and the tidal fields, and then all the small scale fluctuations that you marginalize over will be absorbed by the galaxy bias coefficients associated with these operators. There's also stochastic contribution, of course, which to leading order is Gaussian. So if you analytically modularize over this contribution, you will arrive with the Gaussian likelihood. And then using now this Gaussian likelihood, we can compare within the field level approach individual Fourier modes, mode by mode, with the observations. Let me show you how this works. So again, the data is a three-dimensional cube. So here on the top row, I'm showing 2D slices through the cube, for 2D slices, and then the same for 2D slices on the bottom row from the model prediction. The log likelihood here will illustrate how good a fit is, and as we sample through, you know, configuration, we can start to see that the fit improves, and we identify a better and better configuration that match better and better the observation. So as you can see, like we very quickly identify the dense regions, for example, because those regions have higher signal to noise, and then there will be much more time spent to try to fit the under dense regions where we have low signal to noise. Right, so that's very cool, and about you know, exploring and reconstructing or inferring the density fluctuations in the universe. But again, our goal is to extract cosmological information. So let's focus on that. In this paper, we looked into this approach using just mock data generated from, you know, the same model, but we vary the scale cut of the data. And I want to bring your attention to this plan where I'm showing the constraint on sigma 8, our proxy of sigma 8. So sigma 8 over sigma 8 true. So 1 means unbiased sigma 8 constraint. And then this is the constraint in the plan of sigma 8 and B1. If you remember, we have this perfect degeneracy between them. So from going from green to violet here, we increase the scale cut. So we increase our access to nonlinear clustering information. As you can see, the degeneracy between B1 and sigma 8, or B delta as we call it, can be broken, and then we can pin down exactly what the sigma 8 of the mock data is.
Okay, I'm in. Like, so can you like, yeah, like, can you just comment briefly, you know, on some of the operators that you're including in this analysis? Like, so I see that you have like a B delta and a B grad square delta. You know, what else
yeah,
are you?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, sure. Thanks. Yeah, I didn't want to comment on them here because they are just mock data, but sure, yes. So so B delta is the linear Gaussian mass that we're all familiar with. And then the, for example, B sigma square, as we call it here, is basically the B2, if so B delta square. And then B trace M1, M1 is basically the BK square, the mass coefficient that associates with the tidal fields. And B blah plus delta is basically the trying to capture the higher derivative correction to the Bayes expansion. But yeah, I can come back to them later when we actually consider n-body halos and more more realistic non-bias sorry not more realistic bias traces.
Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah, this is basically the Bayes expansion up to second order. Yeah, so but then again, like we go through so much trouble trying to extract information. So what is the gain? How does it really compare to, you know, just lower endpoint function, for example, 2 and 3 points, which we know very well now how to extract information from. So in this paper with Fabian and Beatrice, we directly compare the field level approach, FBI as we call it, and the power spectrum plus Bayes spectrum approach using a simulation-based inference framework. But what is important for this comparison, for this apple-to-apple comparison, is the fact that both pipelines are based on the same forward model. And we ensure that the comparison happens with on the same Fourier mode, so exactly the same Fourier mode for the two statistics. And so if we do that, in this case on dark matter halos in n-body simulations for the for a volume of 8 gigaparsec cubed, then we can see that in this case for very modest cutoff scales of the analysis, 0.1 and 0.12, the improvement is quite striking, which reached to 3.5 and 5.2 for the field level approach compared to the power spectrum plus Bayes spectrum. Well, does this generalize? We also took another simulations, looked at another halo samples, and I think the conclusion is that the improvement seems to be quite robust. We observed similar improvements for a completely different halo sample at a different redshift. Of course, the exact numbers vary, but I think definitely this shows that there's more information beyond the power spectrum and Bayes spectrum. The question is, of course, can we reach this information with just the tri-spectrum, for example, and this remains to be studied in a follow-up paper.
Min?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, quick question. Is it, so the yellow curve in the bottom panel looks a little bit biased relative to the blue one. Is that at a level that's concerning? Do you feel like you understand that? How should we think about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Jesse. Yes, so right. So we noticed there's a slight bias for the power spectrum plus Bayes spectrum analysis. And in this case, I think we have evidence, which actually we will update the archive paper very soon, is because the fact that in this power spectrum plus Bayes spectrum analysis, we didn't consider non-Gaussian stochasticity. So in the noise model, we didn't consider non-Gaussian contributions. In standard power spectrum plus Bayes spectrum analysis, for example, Fieldkopf or Ivanov et al., you will find that they had to consider this non-Gaussian contribution. In this case, we didn't consider the non-Gaussian contribution because we feel like we want to make an apple-to-apple comparison. And additionally, considering this non-Gaussian contribution will make the improvement factor even bigger. So yes, the short answer is we understand why it's a little biased in this case. But I think the conclusion, as we will show, will just be more aggressive if we include this non-Gaussian contribution. and make it less biased.
Thanks.
Yeah, cool. So that's all cool. That's N-body halos. But how does that work in you know, like with even more realistic galaxies? So in this very nice challenge led by the awesome people at the University of Arizona, which hopefully we'll get to the archive this month. I hope I don't jinx it. But yeah, so this community exercise called Beyond Two-Part Challenge started 2 years ago in Aspen. We are seven international teams come together, which I also saw, like Enrique is here today. And we are given HOD galaxies, so mock galaxies populated on top of N-body halos in N-body simulations using the halo occupation distribution model. So HOD galaxies in different cosmologies and different setups. By that, I mean we are given HOD galaxies either in real space or in resting space or on the light cone. And the challenge is to get the right cosmology out of these realistic traces. So in this case, I will just focus on the real space snapshots, which we participate. And in this case, we fix all the cosmological parameters except sigma 8. So because the only source of information, as I mentioned, to get sigma 8 in these real space snapshots will be from nonlinear clustering. So this is an interesting case study. But of course, it's not super realistic. However, it can tell us whether we have how much we can have access to the nonlinear information. So in this case, you can see, for example, for the case of Barco P, so just the power spectrum, even at very high cutoff Kmax, there's still certain degeneracy between B1 and sigma 8, and then that will also translate into a projection effect, which they suffer from. If we extend the data vector and include, for example, the pi spectrum or the whole fields level, we can start to break this degeneracy and pin down sigma 8. I should also say that the EFT P plus B here is another team, not us. That is Ivanov, Phil Cox, Giovanni Cabas, and a few others. So this is the result after we unmask the true cosmology. As you can see, EFT FBI, even at a very modest cutoff, have a very aggressive constraint, which is also a little biased. And in the post-unmasking study, we try to relax some assumptions. I should also say here that the EFT FBI constraint pre-unmasking was derived even before the paper with the result that I showed today. So in this setup, we use a second order bias and restrict the noise model. So that's why we arrive at this very aggressive constraint. If we now extend the model to cubic bias and allow the noise model to be flexible as we did in the paper that I showed, then this is the constraint that we get. So as you can see, the constraints are now much, I think about 40% or 50% higher than this case. Of course, I wouldn't pay too much attention to a post unmasking result, especially the mean, but I think it's nice to see that the constraints from the field level and the power spectrum and bispectrum within the EFT framework, even though there can be minor differences in the implementations and modeling choices, are broadly consistent. And the way I read this plot is basically, even within quasi-linear regimes, if we try to access more and more information beyond the lower endpoint function, there is certainly promising, at least for sigma 8. So with a few minutes I have left, I want to spend talking about, you know, some things that I'm excited about for this approach. For example, in this approach, we, even though we are very efficient now with sampling the initial conditions, the parameters of the density field, we can even be more efficient if we, instead of doing MCMC sampling, we can try to directly learn the posterior. And there are many people or many groups working on this. And then we just basically here follow a similar path. The only difference in this approach or in our proposal is just that we will try to learn directly the the data, the using from the forward model, from the EFT forward model, instead of from NVD simulations, and then use this trend or learned posterior as a shortcut to evaluate the true posterior. So in a sense, there is no, you know, there's no sense of, in a sense, this is just a way, a shortcut to get the posterior, not like a black box way to get the cosmology, because everything we know about gravity and symmetry is already built into this, you know, forward model. Another thing that we are investigating is basically we don't have to just use the Gaussian positions. In principle, we can also use the Gaussian shapes. In principle, Gaussian shapes are correlated with the large scale tidal fields, because if you imagine a spherical collapse, and then you put that into a large scale tidal field, the tidal field will squeeze or stretch the gases so that you arrive with a gassy shape that aligns with the large scale tidal field. So if we use this fact and we combine sample where we have both gassy positions and gassy shapes, we can help to improve the signal to noise and tighten the cosmological constraints. Finally, a lot of the new physics that we are interested in seem to be restricted to small scales by current constraint. So there's certainly a need to push beyond these quasi-linear regime where EFT is valid. So for those cases, I think we need a hybrid EFT approach as a first step. And there's certain works that need to be, you know, developed, but I think nothing fundamentally prohibited except computational resources and requirements. So with that, I think I come to the conclusion of my talk. Basically, I presented in the first part the sigma attention, and then using the sigma attention as a motivation to go beyond the power spectrum and bispectrum. I reached into the second part where I introduced the field level Bayesian inference FBI approach, trying to squeeze out a sigma constraint from Gaussian clustering. I show constraint for sigma 8 from FBI from nonlinear clustering alone, and showing an improvement, a significant improvement compared to power spectrum plus bispectrum. And all I said today is basically sigma 8 constraints from nonlinear clustering doesn't include any nonlinear redshift space distortion. So of course, when we finally make connections observation, we will have additional constraints for nonlinear redshift space distortion as well. Thank you.
The people are applauding online. And I mean, you said you can't necessarily see people. Does anyone have any questions? I see Mike.
Hi, thanks, Min. Nice talk. I'm wondering about the you know, as you pointed out at the end of the second part, the proof of the pudding is in the testing or in the eating. And yet the HODs are still pretty simple models. You can imagine that there's a lot of physics which is not captured in the HOD, or extensions of HODs like those including assembly bias. So do you have a sense of how robust these results are to more complicated physics than might be captured in these models?
Thanks, Mark, for the question. So yes, so the question is the HOD model might be a little bit too simplistic. In this case, I don't know exactly what HOD model they used to generate the mock data, right? But I think I know at least that these HOD models that they use are the most flexible HOD model. So it's not vanilla HOD, it already includes assembly bias. If I understand their implications correctly, because they cannot, you know, exactly tell me which one, but I'm sure they should already include assembly bias effect. Well, that said, of course, again, the HOD is a simplistic model. You're completely right. So I think that's why in our proposal, we mostly target this quasi-linear scale where a lot of these, you know, complicated physics or binary feedback will not affect our results so strongly. So as you can see here, we limit ourselves to 0.1, and in the other analysis, even it's just on dark matter halos, we just limit to 0.1 to 0.12. But yeah, I agree that if you push it, if you try to push this further, certain complications need to be taken into account. But also the short answer for that is for the EFT framework, there is certainly a limit that like a hard cutoff. So, and within that hard cutoff, I think a lot of these binary physics won't be an issue, or even some systematics like fiber collision.
I see we have a question from Tanvir in the chat, who's unable to turn on his mic. He's wondering, how many simulations do you need to get a generalized enough SBI model? And if you have any comments on how SBI deals with the curse of dimensionality as the models start including more parameters?
Right. Yeah, so this is definitely a question from someone doing SBI. So the question is, how many simulations do we need to train our SBI for the power spectrum plus bias spectrum? I guess because we haven't actually done any SBI for the field level, which I imagine must be even more difficult. So for the power spectrum plus bias spectrum that I showed results in this talk, we actually needed to go beyond 100,000 simulations just to get it converge. And even at least more, but I think one of the reasons is because we restrict ourselves to very modest scale cuts, and on these modest scale cuts we might be subjected to prior volume effect and the fact that the bias coefficients are poorly constrained for power spectrum plus bias spectrum. So I mean it's a trade-off, because on one hand we know that these bias expansion and coefficients will be better constraints for API. and then on the other hand, of course, it's harder to train the model the bigger your input data vector gets. So I don't have an intuition for the case of FBI doing SBI with fields level or FBI. But these, at least these are the numbers that we have for the power spectrum plus bias spectrum.
Sorry, and just for me, can you remind me what SBI stands for?
SBI stands for simulation-based inference. So in this approach, you use you simulate a pair of cosmology and any associated nuisance parameters and the data vector. So you use the pair of cosmology and input data vector to train your neural network to predict either the likelihood or the posterior. And in this case, this plot is showing the I should have explained this plot for the audience. So this plot is showing the uncertainty on alpha or sigma 8 in the SBI framework compared to the uncertainty predicted by the Fisher forecast. And this is a function of the simulations to show you the conversions. So as you can see, we expect the conversions when this ratio start to become stable or at least close to one. It doesn't have to be one, but it should be close to one. And then as you can see for all of these samples and at both cutoffs, the number of simulations that we need to reach convergence is actually quite high. So it's about 100,000 here. But you can see that they start to converge over 100,000.
And I'm sure you've explained this, but just so you're making a distinction between this and the FBI. So
yeah,
that
correct.
Is not based on N-body simulations?
Right. No. The data is N-body simulation, but I think could have explained this better. But no, so the data is N-body simulations, but for the field level framework, there is no training data. You just plug in the N-body halos as your input data. And then the likelihood is actually analytic. The covariance is also analytic. And then you just try to infer from n-body positions, n-body halos positions. Sorry. Does that answer your question?
I think so. I think this is more on me for missing it earlier in your talk than is. But how do you get the analytic likelihood for the field level? Is it like it's not the 1D PDF or?
Right. So the likelihood is basically just a Gaussian, and you can see this is the Gaussian fields in Fourier space. This is observed Gaussian fields or the observed halo fields in Fourier space, and then this is the model prediction also in Fourier space. So yeah, so it's just a Gaussian likelihood. And then from EFT and from theory, we have some certain prediction for the form of the covariance. It should be diagonal, for example, with some free parameters that we also infer.
Should I be thinking of this as like a PDF, just a probability?
I think you can also just think about it as you have, so your input data vector is the entire field, so individual Fourier modes. So you can also think it up about this in real space, is that easier. So each grid point is a parameter. You don't have to think about it as the PDF. You can just think about, you really have a box of Gaussians with a number of grid points, and each grid point or each voxel is then a parameter.
Well, so you're working in real space or in redshift space? Sorry.
So sometimes I say real space. What I mean is to distinguish between real space and Fourier space. But everything we discussed today, there's no redshift space distortion.
Oh, there's no RSD. I see. Okay. So then but then for your comparison with that blind test, that was all presumably in redshift space, right?
No, this is in real space. Yeah, sorry, I could have mentioned this more clearly. So we have different setups in this Beyond 2-Part Challenge. We have real space catalogs, and then we have also redshift space catalogs. For this result that I have been showing, the results coming from the real space catalogs. So there's no redshift space distortion information here. That's why you see Marco P having this huge degeneracy and huge inflated constraint on sigma 8. If this is in redshift space, you will see a very aggressive constraint from Marco P because they have then access to the redshift space information.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is just real space, yeah.
And so one more question actually that I had, so for your next slide, I think it was, showing, So the difference between the darker and lighter bands was that the darker one, only has up to second order coefficients and the lighter one includes third order.
Yeah. So this plot is a bit confusing because both teams want to show the post unmasking study. The darker ones are the pre-unmasking, are the results that we submitted before unmasking. And in that case, the EFT FBI use a second order bias model with the assumption that the Gaussy shot noise is Poisson. So we fix the amplitude of the shot noise to Poisson. On the other hand, the EFT P plus B team assume a third order bias and allowing the shot noise amplitude to be free. So you can see that they have very extended constraints. After unmasking, we said, let's try to match the other team's assumption. So each team is now going in the opposite directions. So EFT API is trying to extend to third order bias and allow the shot noise amplitude to be free. Why now EFT P plus B trying to restrict the second order bias and assume the shot noise is Poisson. So then you will see for EFT P plus B, the error bars shrink, and EFT API is the error bars inflate.
By Poisson, do you mean 1 over N?
One over N, exactly.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So that's why we think this is biased because, we don't communicate too much information, but from the EFTP plus VTIM and from our own analysis, we know that the shot noise for these MOS are not really Poisson.
Yeah, sure. Okay, but is the increase in your error bar from the darker to the lighter, so is that coming from, you know, like, well, so is that mostly just from having additional bias terms?
Both from additional bias terms and from the shot noise amplitude.
Being a free parameter, I see. Okay.
We have a hand raised from Salim or Salim's computer, at least.
Yeah, hi everybody. I think we have a few questions in the room.
Hi.
I think it's really exciting that this stuff works so well. So one question I have, like, there was a lot of concern about whether, like, in the past, whether the sampling process actually, like, the HMC sampling process actually covers the posterior well, or whether you would get stuck in some local minimum. And then there's also, like, as you know, it's very high dimension. And so one thing, like, how many samples do you draw, and how many independent samples do you draw, and how confident are you that this is not a problem?
Yes, right. So thanks for providing all the context for your question. Yes, so that is indeed a concern. In our analysis, we try to be, you know, we try to be as careful as we can. So, for example, for the result that I show, I typically run about 8 to 10 MCMC chains to test for convergence. For example, in this case, this is for the Halo, Embody Halos, one of the results that I show. I run, in this case, in 8 MCMC chains, and one of them started from the true initial conditions, because these are our own data and we have access to the true initial conditions of the simulations. So So one way we have been using to judge whether the chains, you know, converge to the same posterior minima or what or maxima is basically looking at the trace plot and seeing whether the one that starts from the true initial conditions agree well with the ones that start from some random initial conditions. Random initial conditions, I mean, like the animation that I showed earlier. So in this case, you can see that the one starts from true initial conditions actually show no difference in behavior compared to the one starts from random initial conditions. And if you look at the posterior,
how about the phases, the sampling of the phases, but of the actual initial conditions, they also.
Right. I don't think I have this plot there. Here, but in our paper we have such a plot, and typically we also look, because I mean we cannot look at individual Fourier phases, but we did look at, for example, the cross correlation coefficients as a way to summarize all the information, and typically they arrive at this, more or less the same Fourier space cross correlation coefficient, which tells us that basically, you know, these chains starting from very different points in the million space of parameter, they typically convert to the same, typical set, probably the same phases. And yeah, so one way you can also look at is the convergence or consistency between posteriors of these chains before you combine. So these are the 8 chains that I run for this case, for example, and their posterior seems to be quite consistent to me. But of course, this is like one simple diagnostic that we use. For the questions about the effective sample size, it depends on the case and the cutoffs, but we typically try to aim for, you know, at least 100 to 300 effective samples. But again, I agree that one challenge of this approach, which is only computational, but it is there, is the fact that there's a long correlation between the cosmological parameters and the for the cosmological parameters. Actually, the correlation for the phases is much shorter, but for alpha or sigma 8, there is a long correlation, and that's why usually we have to run for like very long MCMC chains. So in this case, you can see that some chains I have to run until like 200,000 just to gather enough effective sample size.
Okay, thank you. I have some more questions, but I'll pass it on to Boris.
Sure.
Hi, it's Boris. So I have a naive question about this conclusion that you made that there is more information in the field-level approach than in P plus V or endpoint functions in general. So there, naively, if you impose, a very aggressive scale cut and you cut most of the nonlinear part in the field, so by imposing this stochastic noise more or less everywhere where there is corresponding to nonlinear scales. So do you see both posteriors converge toward the same answer, or can you test something like that?
So in this case, I think at least in this case, or this case for that matter, we see very we observe very good convergence in the sense that both posteriors are consistent, well consistent with each other. And if you increase the scale cut, now you can see that the constraints are improving for both analysis. But it's just that the FBI typically have a better, a better improvement with scale cuts, and I think that makes sense at least to me because we expect the improvement to increase with scale cuts faster for FBI, right? Because the nonlinear information should be increasing. The nonlinear information that is located beyond the power spectrum and the bispectrum should be increasing faster. Should be increasing with scale cuts. So I think at least for these cases that we looked at, it is consistent. And one thing you should keep in mind about this improvement factor is the fact that the power spectrum plus bispectrum at these scale cuts, they typically not very, so this is not the optimal scale cut for the power spectrum plus bispectrum, so to speak. So another way to frame these questions is now to say, well, hey, if you just use power spectrum and bispectrum, you are free to push to whatever scale cuts you are confident with. And this is what this team did in the analysis. So you can see that the scale cuts are much more aggressive. And then, of course, you will have better constraints. And then the improvement factor between the two approaches there will be, I guess, less aggressive. If we can put it that way. Again, I think everything looks at least to me consistent, but it's just different way to look at things.
Yeah, it's just in the plot at the top of the previous slide that you had with the posters. Yeah, would you not expect, even a better? I mean, here the blue FBI line is still very much narrower than what you get with P plus B. Would you not expect, both posteriors to converge, maybe even exactly as you remove more and more small scales?
More and more small scales. You mean like make this so restrict this to even lower Kmax, you mean?
Yes.
Oh yes. Then I would expect them to converge. Yeah, that's one thing we could do to test it, yes. Right, I agree.
I see. Thank you.
Just with an eye on the time, I suggest let's all thank Min again. And I again, if people want to chat more with him, there's a sign-up sheet with his contact info and schedule to make room for more chatting. But thanks, Min, very much for a very interesting talk. And
Thank you.
yeah, enjoy the rest of
I
your
will
day.
be here for the day. Yeah.